From your world news headquarters on the World Wide Web, it's time for your daily dose of sanity. This is the Maria Heller Show. Maria Heller is a published author and founder of The Universal Wheel, a lifestyle and philosophy based on our interconnectedness to all living things, a Reiki master, and delivers the news with spiritual views. How many intuitive news decoders, animal rights activists, and vegetarian broadcasters are there? Just one. Maria. Maria has provided independent news for a smart audience for over 13 years now on the Maria Heller Show, available at maria.net.
M-E-R-I-A.net.
And now, here is your host, the mouth that roars, Maria Heller.
Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. And I have a special guest for you today, and I'll preempt it with, who are you going to call? And it's not Ghostbusters. We're going to call on Growthbusters. And that's the title of today's show. Let me tell you about my guest. His name is Dave Gardner. He is a producer, a director, a writer of the documentary Growthbusters, Hooked on Growth. He's worked as a professional director for over 30 years. He's directed documentaries and award-winning projects for a long list of Fortune 500 clients and PBS. Even more interesting, Dave decided to run for Colorado Springs City Council in 2009 on the platform that true community prosperity could only be achieved by increasing efficiency and localization. Not the pot of gold at the end of the everlasting growth rainbow. And his movie is basically called Growthbusters, Hooked on Growth. And I'm very happy to have Dave with me. So good morning, Dave.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Oh, no. Thank you for the work you do. Because, you know, we live in a world when you try to talk to people about growth or, oh, God forbid that ugly word, overpopulation, they seem to lose their marbles. It's like nobody wants to hear it.
That's true, but you know, we've got a system that is really not delivering good lives for us anymore. So I think we should be more open-minded to questioning, what we've been doing for the last couple hundred years.
Absolutely. You know, through the years of doing my show, I remember many years ago, because I've been doing this online for 14 years, a gentleman who, you know, basically said that the downturn really began with the growth of agriculture in this country.
Well, even worldwide, you know, in the history of man, the sociologists, the biologists, all the scientists who have looked at it kind of agree that that when we began to practice agriculture, that really opened up the possibility for overpopulating the world. And I guess I should back up for a minute and say that my concerns in the Growthbusters film that I directed really are about the scale of the human enterprise outgrowing the planet. And that is certainly, population is a big part of that, but also the size of our economy plays a huge role. So it's really kind of a two-part equation. But the population, started to grow for the first time in the history of human civilization, really. Global population started to grow when we started figuring out how to grow crops and store food, through the tough times.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what made you decide to become a political activist? What made you decide to run for office? I mean, you live in Colorado, I think, right?
Yes, I do.
And, isn't Colorado a pretty environmentally conscious state?
Well, you would think so, but I do live in a conservative stronghold in the state. I live in the town of Colorado Springs, which is the most conservative, just about the most conservative place in the state of Colorado. And you'd be surprised that, you know, people expect Colorado to be a leader in renewable energy and a leader in recycling and, that we ought to have a profound appreciation for all of nature because of all the natural beauty that blesses us. But that, isn't necessarily the case. Our state is as hooked on growth as just about any other part of North America, really.
Right.
But for politics called me just because I really do believe that we have to think globally but act locally. Most of us feel like, it's impossible to make a difference when it comes to national public policy, for example. Very challenging. Well, local public policy, you know, any one single citizen, you know, actually, there's a great chance that you can make a difference in your own community. So I stepped up just like I think we all should.
Well, I've been a firm believer in that slogan since it came out, which had to be like, I don't know, I want to say at least in the 70s, you know, think globally and act locally.
Yes, ma'am.
And now, you know, you look at a lot of people starting to become more aware, even around the holiday season, you know, saying the same thing, you know, shop your local, you know, mom and pop stores. You know, stop supporting these giant corporations, which are also killing the planet.
Yeah, and it turns out, you know, that we have, you know, we're in a post-peak oil world, and we're not in any danger of running out of oil right away. But we, you know, the evidence is pretty clear that oil is never going to be as cheap and easy as it once was. The, you know, the first thing we did when we discovered the tremendous power of fossil fuels is we, you know, we took the easy stuff that that was, you know, just beneath our feet. Now we have run out of the easy stuff, clearly, or we wouldn't be drilling in you know, in mile deep oceans and considering drilling in the Arctic Ocean and fracking, you know, next to elementary schools. We wouldn't be doing that if there was still plenty of easy oil to get. And so that means that energy is going to be more and more expensive going forward, and that's going to completely change the way we live, because it's just not going to be cost-effective for us to buy products, and especially food, that had to be that had to travel 1,500 miles or more. So localization is the future.
Right. Well, most people don't realize that their food travels more than they do. You know, they just expect that they're going to have all this exotic food in their supermarket 24/7, you know, every month of the year, and not realize the impact of what that does to the planet.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting. Most people, when you don't think about it, you think globalization has really unlocked this amazingly wonderful life for us. And in some ways it has. It's made it possible for you to have, you know, to have tomatoes in the middle of winter. It made it possible for us to get products really inexpensively because we can have them made wherever, you know, labor is willing to work for next to nothing. And they're also cheap because it made it possible for polluting activities to be done in places that don't care, that they'd rather have the money than have the clean air. So we get to have the clean air and the cheap products that require pollution because the pollution's out of sight. But it's that out-of-sight thing that really is tripping us up. You know, we don't see the impacts of so many of the impacts of our behavior. Mm-hmm. And in a full world, we have over 7 billion people today. There's really no longer any way to throw that stuff. It's coming back to haunt us. Climate change, of course, is the easy example. It doesn't matter where in the world carbon dioxide is being emitted. It is going to impact the climate around the world.
Right. Well, you just look at China, how many days that they actually closed down entire cities. People can't even go to school or anything because the air pollution is so disgusting.
Yeah, but even as stunning is the fact that what they do in China, you know, impacts the air quality on the west coast of the United States.
Yeah, but you know what? That's a hard one for people to understand, and I keep screaming as I have all these years. You know, the world is a circle. What goes around comes around. I mean, look at Fukushima.
Absolutely. But, you know, it used to be Paul Ehrlich, the famous Stanford biologist that I interviewed for the Growthbusters movie, has a great way of saying it. You know, he says, we used to be able to live in this cowboy economy, you know, where you could, a cowboy, you know, back in the days of the Old West could camp in a, you know, in a wash somewhere overnight and not really worry too much about his waste products because he'd get up the next morning, he'd move on. And there'd be another valley or another arroyo where he could camp. And by the time he came back, all the way back around to where he had camped, you know, 5 years, you know, earlier, nature had cleaned up after him. Well, you could do that, you know, when there were fewer than a billion people on the planet. But when there's over 7 billion people on the planet, you know, our accidents, they hurt somebody. They, you know, you just can't get away from people anymore. So every impact today, we have to make sure that we minimize it enough so that the nature actually has a chance to clean up behind us.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, looking at you in your film, and I have to tell you, it's kind of hysterical watching you going around in a Ghostbusters, full Ghostbuster regalia, and I'm walking through the streets of Colorado Springs. You know, outside of having a few good laughs, you know, what you cover in the film is super important. And, you know, these are things, as an environmentalist, I've been talking about, you know, at least since the 80s. And when I look at it and watching you in the film, you know, it's a good guess you're also, you know, a baby boomer. I think about some of the conversations I have with my friends now who remember the way it used to be and say that it wasn't worth the trade-off.
Absolutely. It is stunning how long we have known that we were, you know, starting to bump up against the limits to growth on this planet, and how long we've put off really getting serious about it. There was that period of time when I was really a teenager, you know, back when Paul Ehrlich published the Population Bomb, and when the Club of Rome published the Limits to Growth study. And so I had this, you know, this brief period where, you know, I was aware that population growth was a problem, and actually that had an impact on me. I chose to stop after conceiving two children, but it seems like most of us boomers got distracted. You know, we just started enjoying the good life and forgot about everything we were protesting and caring about back in the late 60s. And it's easy to do. And I think in my case, I can only speak for myself, but I think the main thing that drove me was having kids. You know, once you have kids, your life changes and you really want to provide a good life for them. And so I got so focused on just wanting to be a good provider. That meant for me, you know, I needed to make a good living so that they could have everything that they want, so that they could go to college, so that they always had food on the table. And, you know, unfortunately, for most of us, I think that distracted us because we forgot, number one, that even more than that, what our kids want is they want our time. And so a lot of us, you know, we traded in our time with our kids in order to be at the office, you know, making money, thinking that we were doing our kids a big favor. And in a way, that's kind of a metaphor for everything that's happened to our culture, as the definition of the good life got hijacked, and we got on this treadmill where we were seeking more material wealth, and we were giving up time and the simple pleasures of life, which are really what really makes us happy.
Absolutely. I don't think that we were born, you know, to work ourselves to death 24/7 just to get stuff.
No, but we forget that. It's easy to forget that in this day and age because we're just bombarded with messages about, you know, how we define progress, how we define success. You know, we've been programmed from birth to believe that relaxing is makes you a slacker. You know, we're achievement oriented, and we look down on people who are, you know, content to work with their hands, would rather go fishing than work through lunch. The people that we have come to admire are the people who do work 60 hours a week. And why do we admire them? Well, because we've come to kind of, we have this keep up with the Joneses kind of mentality, and we look at their acquisitions. Wow, they have a summer home in the north and a winter home in the south. Wow, they have a ski condo. Wow, they're driving a luxury car. Wow, look at that trophy house. They must really be good at what they do. They are successful. And the truth is, inside those trophy McMansions, they're not any happier. In fact, in most cases, they're less happy than the rest of us.
Absolutely, you know, but somehow along the line we were sold that bill of goods, that this was the American dream.
Yep.
You know, you remember that bumper sticker, whoever dies with the most toys wins?
Yeah.
You know, well, guess what? You don't win because you're already dead and you can't take those toys with you.
That's right, and it's a real cliche, you know, no one on his deathbed ever wishes he had spent more time at the office, but it couldn't be more true, and I think that's a really great guide to just, you know, for your everyday living, to ask yourself, well, what, you know, am I spending my time doing something that I'm really going to be glad I did when I am on my deathbed? And I really don't think working through lunch or spending, you know, 4 hours in a day commuting so that you can have a higher paying job. I don't think those are the things that you're going to be glad you did. And you never get that time back.
Right. Once it's gone, it's gone. Well, you know, here we live in a nation where, I don't know about you, Dave, but it really bothers me when I hear or read in the papers, you know, the president or whomever talking to us as consumers. They never refer to us as citizens anymore. Now we're consumers.
That is my pet peeve. I want everyone to just raise their window and put their head out and say, I am not a consumer. I am a human being. I refuse to use the word consumers, but that is exactly what this system has turned us into. And unfortunately, when you're talking about leaving a good world, a world worth inheriting for our kids and their kids for future generations, that requires that our primary identification not be as a consumer, but be as a steward. Consuming doesn't make us happy. Yeah, we've got this system. Well, we've become so addicted to economic growth that it's our duty to go to the mall and go spend money in order to create more jobs, so that the economy meets this measure of success. And the problem is our measure of success is all wrong. It's like driving a car and only looking at the speedometer. That does you no good if the car is, you know, aiming straight at a cliff.
Right. You know, I remember years ago interviewing Dr. Bernie Siegel, and he had written a great book for kids and about kids. And he mentioned in there that one of his sons had said to him one day, Dad, when I'm successful, I'm going to be happy. And Bernie said to his son, Son, you got it backwards. If you're happy, you're successful.
That is beautiful. That's brilliant.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think about that often as I watch people, you know, trying to, you know, get ahead, you know, the rat race and whatnot, buy the latest this, the latest that. And they don't realize that at the end of the day, they're still not happy because they really didn't do anything for themselves. They didn't spend any time outdoors. They didn't spend any time with friends. And I think that that's another part of the downside of technology, Dave, is people seem to be becoming even more isolated.
Yes, and that is one of the downsides of the technology. It certainly does take us away from each other. And actually, it turns out that all the studies of happiness show that what really makes us happy is our human relationships. I think the other downside of technology is that's kind of become our it's another one of those things that we have to consume, that we're not content to be using a mobile phone that we purchased 5 years ago.
Right.
In fact, we're not content to be using a mobile phone we purchased a year ago. We have to have the latest. And that creates jobs, that drives economic throughput, and just during the last 50 years, in the public policy arena, that's how we started measuring progress and success. And that's why politicians have to promise us economic growth. No politician can be elected or keep their job by telling us the truth. And the truth is that economic growth doesn't make us happy, and economic growth is actually the ruin of our world. We've got to come up with a new measure and a new way, a new dialogue, a new vocabulary. We need to talk about economic health, not economic growth.
Right. Well, you know, the downside of all these new gadgets and whatnot is we're draining the planet's resources. I mean, these cell phones take a whole lot of resources to make. And on the other hand, every time somebody updates their phone or laptop, whatever, you know, that's more garbage in the landfills.
It is, and some of the raw materials that go into our electronics are probably some of the first that we're going to really bump into scarcity issues. There's a great book called Scarcity by Chris Clugston, where this guy really, I mean, talk about a nerd. This guy really went into looked at all the data and evaluated all the non-renewable resources and all the evidence of how much supply there remains, and it's really pretty scary. We are like right on the edge, Maria, of finding out just what we have wrought on this planet. The next 20 years are not going to be anything like the last 20.
Or anything like the last 40. Why even stop there? You know, when I look at when I was a young girl, You know, we had so much before us, you know, that everything was, you know, looking ahead. And now everything seems to be just dwindling in the opposite direction. I mean, what are we using now? 1.5 the planet's resources, but we only have one planet.
Yeah, but we're painting a bleak picture here, and that's one of the reasons why I did put that outfit on and call the film Growthbusters and have a little bit of fun with the similarity to Ghostbusters, because you really do have to have a little bit of a sense of humor and not take yourself too serious.
Oh, yeah.
If you're going to be addressing what I consider really the most critical question ever to face humanity, which is, you know, how do we need to organize our system and our lives to live sustainably on the planet? So we do have to step back and have a little bit of a sense of humor, and we need a source of optimism. And for me, the source of optimism is that this system that we've created, that we, you know, that used to deliver a good life for us, mm-hmm. it got out of hand, and now, you know, it's certainly trashing our planet, and we know that can't continue. But the good news is it's really not delivering a good life anymore. It actually has imprisoned us, and we're all toiling on this treadmill in service to this growth-obsessed system. And so it's not bad. It's not going to be a big sacrifice for us to jettison that system, to reorganize our lives around what really matters. It's going to be challenging as heck. But it's going to be a real freeing kind of a thing. It's going to give us the opportunity to get back in touch with what really counts in life.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to agree with you, because we sure are living in interesting times. I like the way you put it. You had in the movie where I believe it, you said we no longer live in an empty world.
Yeah, you know, I think I might have borrowed that from Herman Daly, maybe, who was a great economist. He used to be a senior economist at the World Bank, and he left there because that was a part of this growth-obsessed system, and he makes so much sense. That, you know, there are economists who make a lot of sense, not enough of them, but he is really good at explaining to people how economics in a full world is different. You know, growth no longer pays. Growth starts to cost us more than it provides, and it's really clear that we're at that point. And in fact, you mentioned that we're using the Earth's resources as though we had 1.5 planets. We actually kind of crossed over the threshold, the one planet threshold, back in the mid-70s, and yet, you know, we thought life kept on improving. You know, no one would say, wow, things really got bad in the mid-70s. But something kind of tricky did happen back then. One thing is that happiness really did flatline. Our happiness hasn't really improved in the industrialized world since then. And what we've really been fooling ourselves since then with this illusion of prosperity from growth, mostly by borrowing. That's about the time that borrowing just started to go through the roof. So we've been borrowing for 40 years on this bet that next year growth is going to start to pay off again. Mm. But eventually, you know, that chicken comes home to roost, and that's where we are today. That's why this great recession that we've been in for several years now, that's why it's lasted longer than recessions in the past. It's not a normal cycle. I believe we really are at the end of growth. And we can't change that. We can waste a lot of time and resources trying to reinvigorate that economic growth. But the planet's full, the planet has said enough, and it's not going to allow that to happen. So the best thing we can do is embrace the end of growth and stop wasting time and resources trying to relive the last 50 years, because they're done. They're behind us.
Right. Well, Dave, let me ask you this, and I'm sure I'm not the first person to ask you this. Don't you think that science and technology can save us or save the day? You know, I'm being a little devil's advocate there.
I know you are, and I appreciate that. You know, I appreciate the opportunity. Technology has done some wondrous things, but the truth is, if you really look at it, it's got a mixed track record. You know, technology gave us DDT, asbestos, a lot of carbon dioxide emissions. And a lot of the benefits of technology have really been benefits of the tremendous power of fossil fuels. for example, the Green Revolution. The Green Revolution, most of the benefits of you know, that where we've been able to feed a much bigger population than we ever thought we could are really because we're converting oil and natural gas into fertilizer and industrialized agriculture, which can't be, you know, we won't be able to do that in 100 years because the supply of fossil is diminishing, and of course, we're baking the climate as we use them.
Absolutely. Well, look at all this fracking, okay? The Oklahoma had a 4.5 this week, and they're certainly connecting it to the fracking going on. And look at all the water it takes just to extract a little bit of oil from sand.
Oh, yeah. It's ridiculous. It's technology. You know, there are plenty of champions of technology, so I choose not to champion it because it's a huge bet that technology will be able to deliver the same miracles during this century that it did last century. And I would rather bet on the sure thing, which is getting back in touch with what really counts in life. That's a sure thing. That makes your life happier, and we know that it doesn't lead to disaster.
Right. Okay, so what really counts in life?
time with the people you love. There's a gentleman, Mike Nickerson, a Canadian that I interview in the film, who says it really well. He says the three L's are the things that we have room in the world for a lot more of: loving, learning, and laughing.
I like that. I absolutely like that. You know, years ago when Al Gore came out with his ecological footprint, I remember he had something set up online where you can go in and do some sort of a survey to see what your footprint is. And I remember doing it, you know, curiosity, and also because, as one of my sisters who frowns upon me says, I live like a European. I did the little survey, and my footprint was zero. Too bad we can't say the same for Al Gore, right?
Yeah, that's really true. But you bring up Europeans, and I'm glad you did, because Europeans do have a significantly smaller footprint than we in North America do. We're kind of the hogs of the planet. And, you know, we spend a lot of money to go vacation in Europe to enjoy the good life that the Europeans have year-round.
Mm-hmm. I know, it's true. And when
Something
you look at, you know...
From that.
Right. But, you know, to me, you know, what's important, you know, I look at, and I have the occasion, I don't know whether you do, with your personality, I'm sure you do, but I have the occasion to talk to a lot of really young people, okay? We're talking teenagers, high schoolers. And when they come to me, you know, I guess they see me as, you know, the grandma of the world, and they're very confused now as far as whether they should go to college, what should I do, what should I study, you know, and they also have a lot of fear. You know, they are not stupid. They see what's happening in the world. And my advice to these kids is always the same. Learn a trade. Learn how to cook. Learn how to sew. Learn how to cut hair. Learn how to, you know, be a plumber, an electrician. Learn how to grow food. These are not things being taught in the schools. I don't know about you, but, you know, when I went to school, we took classes called home economics. You know, we took classes, you know, on civic duty. You know, and they seem to be sorely missing in our schools. But what really bothers me is a lot of the children that I'm meeting, even though they're wonderful and very decent, confide in me that they are severely depressed and suffering anxiety and panic attacks. And Dave, these are kids 16 and 17.
That's really sad. And yeah, I think they're faced with a really important choice, which is one, do they believe that the world is going to continue like it did during this binge that humanity was on, in which case they, you know, borrow money, go to college, and then they're stuck sitting in some city waiting for someone to give them a job, and they starve if someone won't give them a job. Or do they learn a trade, or do they get involved in this growing resilience movement that I really think is a growing model for how the economy of the future is going to be healthy, and that is where a local economy, and that's where people are instead of throwing things away, they're repairing things. They're creating durable products, and then they repair them and keep them running. They grow food. I really believe that people who can grow food will be some of the better paid people of the future, because, mm-hmm. you know, we need food. We can
absolutely.
And if you know how to grow food, mm-hmm. and you have a little bit of land, then you don't have to sit and wait for some mega corporation in some other city to give you a job in order to survive.
Absolutely. And even if you don't know how to grow food, I mean, I know that Colorado's terrain is kind of very similar to Arizona in a lot of places. And I suggest that people take one of these nature tours. Most of the time, Native Americans lead them. Just take a tour and learn the food that's already available to you in nature, just in case you really have nothing else to eat.
Yep.
You know, I did that when I first moved to Arizona, and I was blown away. I had no idea cactus had any purpose whatsoever, but wow, did I learn a lot.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned water when you brought up fracking. You know, water is going to be, water and food are the things you just can't live without. And water crises are widely predicted. And so you want to try to find a way to make sure that you have access to those two things going forward.
Absolutely. Dave, we're going to go to a short break, but when we get back, of course, I want to continue this conversation. Because you do talk about in your film that we need a new cultural narrative, and I'd like to discuss what you mean by that. So stay with us. Dave and I will be right back.
Relationships. You hear a lot of experts talk endlessly about having a successful relationship, but do they? Maria has combined her years of experience, spirituality, knowledge, wit, and wisdom about relationships into one small, concise, useful book, Relationships Cutting to the Chase. The most important relationship of all is the relationship you have with yourself. If you're not in a loving, healthy relationship with yourself, you'll continue to have problems in all types of relationships. Maria shows you how to have one and great relationships of all sorts in her latest book. You can find the book at maria.net, that's M-E-R-I-A.net, under Maria's books, Stop Suffering and Enjoy a Happy Life with Fulfilling Relationships. You may decide to buy one for everyone you know. Order your copy now at maria.net. Now back to this fascinating show.
Hey, welcome back. I'm speaking with my guest, Dave Garner, the producer, editor, star of the film Growth Busters. You had me singing this song ever since I saw you, movie, Dave. Hooked on Growth. Before the break, we were talking about, you mentioned in there that we need a new cultural narrative. Do you think our consumerism is our culture?
Well, I think that's a big part of it, but I think I would... It's just a part of what our cultural narrative is today, which I think is a story that more is better, and that more is always possible. It's a story of continuous improvement, which I believe in continuous improvement, but the story kind of got sidetracked to mean continuous increases in income, increases in material wealth, living higher on the hog year after year. That's kind of become the cultural narrative, and so consumerism is a huge part of that. And what it says is that's the key to life. That's the good life. That's the key to happiness, and that everyone's entitled to it, and that any theory, any system, any proposal that gets in the way of that is, considered, a public enemy number one. And it's such a strong narrative that, I kind of joked about it a little bit in the film, I think, but it's not really a joke. And that is that if I was trying to pick something to make a film about, it's something to actually try to change about the world, which is what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I couldn't have picked a tougher thing to do. It would have been easier for me to set out to convince the world that the Pope is the Antichrist or that God doesn't exist. Because this worship of growth, of more, is really, I think, the most powerful religion in the world. It's more powerful than Christianity, Hinduism, Judaism, Islam. You could combine all of them because there are more people in the world who have buy this myth that growth is the path to prosperity than there are who buy any other religious belief. So that's our cultural narrative, and it is, it's only a 200-year-old narrative. Most of our human history, we didn't subscribe to that. So I know it can't be so powerful that we can't unseat it.
Right.
But we have a short memory, and so we think that that we have the final answer here, that this is it, this is the way life is supposed to be. And so it's very challenging to shake our faith in that. But there's a lot of there's a lot of propaganda daily that we get. I call it the Kool-Aid. We're served Kool-Aid every day that reinforces that myth that growth is necessary for prosperity. So a lot of my activity is really built on trying to take away the power of that propaganda. The film Growth Busters was one of the ways. I also have a new website called growthbiasbusted.org, where every day we highlight that propaganda in the mainstream media. Just yesterday, I put on the wall of shame a story about about GDP growth in the U.S. being so robust last quarter, and I point out all the ways that a reporter who is considered a respected journalist and we think is objective, but has been programmed from birth to believe that economic growth is good, and so they use all of these words and phrases that really kind of silently, insidiously reinforce in our minds that economic growth is an important public goal. But I believe once people become aware of that, that starts to take away the power. That's one big step in changing that cultural narrative.
Right. Well, when you look around, I mean, we have so much poverty in the United States, so many homeless people, so many homeless children in schools, so many people on food stamps. I don't remember a time like this in my lifetime, do you? So I don't see where the growth is benefiting the average American.
No, that's really true. But you know what I think is making it hard for us to change the narrative is that so many people have come to believe in it that even though the system isn't, working for them, they still believe, they're hanging on to this thread of hope that the system can work for them. Somehow, they just haven't gotten something right, so they're not ready to throw away the system because the system says, you can have it all. It's possible. It's the American dream. You can go from rags to riches. But so many people are finding they can't seem to get to riches, but they're just reluctant to let go of that dream. Very challenging.
Well, that's a dream we were sold a long time ago. I see a poster, on social media every now and then that somehow goes along the lines of, there are no poor people in America, just people waiting to become millionaires. Because
that is so true.
Right. But, when I look around, I think about when I was a young girl, when pretty much everybody was poor where I grew up, but, poor by the world standards. But when I talk to people about my childhood, I realized just how wealthy we were. We didn't have things, okay? My dad had 5 kids. He was a barber. He was supporting 7 people. We had, very few of the finer things in life. We didn't have a car till I was 12 years old. Food was, when it was there, when it wasn't, but we had music playing all the time. My parents had company over all the time, their friends, laughter. We had a camaraderie with each other. Tons of friends. Everybody in the neighborhood knew everybody else. Everybody knew everybody else's kids. And when you look at, the price we paid for the American dream, like I said earlier, it wasn't worth the trade-off.
Yeah, you really have hit the nail on the head. And I see people who are, struggling to make ends meet. They don't know how they're going to put food on the table for their kids next week, but they have an iPhone. And I'm not criticizing them or denigrating them, but that's just kind of where our culture is today.
Priorities.
Yeah, we've forgotten how to entertain ourselves. Entertainment is cheap. You can play a game with your kids. You can, tell stories. There are lots of ways to commune together that do not require all of this electronic technology, unfortunately.
Absolutely.
So we have to have it.
Absolutely. I mean, just to give you an example, a couple of weekends ago, my 18-year-old granddaughter came up with her boyfriend. And what did they want to do? Okay, they didn't say, let's sit here and play Xbox. They said, can we play Scrabble or Boggle? Or, when I sat down, believe me, it was so many board games, I couldn't take it anymore. but just kept going because children still enjoy doing the same things we did if they're given the chance.
You know, my kids, I think back to, I need to ask them, but I'm pretty confident that if I ask, my kids are grown now, but if I ask them what about their favorite memories from growing up of time with Dad, you know, I'm pretty sure that they would talk about how at bedtime we would sit down, you know, sit down on the bed and I would tell them a story. I would make up a story.
Oh, I did that too.
It did not require any technology at all. What it meant, it just meant that their dad loved them enough that he, you know, that he just spent time, you know, looking right in their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I live in Colorado Springs and we have this gorgeous, abundant nature and we have this beautiful city park called Garden of the Gods. Huge rock formations that people come from all over the world to see. And last summer I was in the park at one of the more scenic spots and I looked around and here are all these people who I have traveled from mostly outside the city to appreciate it. There were probably within eyeshot maybe 30 people that I could see. And I bet you 28 of the 30 people, were they looking at Pike's Peak? Were they looking at the rock formations? No. They had their head down and they were looking at their mobile phone.
That's very sad.
Yeah.
That's very, well, listen, when the kids come watching through my house, they know the phones are off. Okay, and it still pisses off not only my kids, but my friends, too, that I refuse to have a cell phone. Okay, I don't like the intrusion in my space. Okay,
sure.
Whatever I'm doing outdoors or away from home, I want to be fully present to it.
Well, I hope we're going to move back to that, but it seems like it's taking a long time for to shake people's faith in this system that is no longer delivering the good life.
Well, maybe when people are now becoming more aware of the fact that every gadget they have is being used to spy on them, they might have a second thought about it.
Yeah, but you know what I think also, because we're, you know, I used to think that I needed to help convince people to stop growth, but I soon discovered that growth was coming to a stop, whether we liked it or not. And so the end of growth, you know, as evidenced by this recession, in a way, you know, it's painful, it's challenging if you don't have a job. Believe me, I understand that. But in a way, it's forcing us to do the right thing because it is forcing us to figure out ways to live lighter on the planet. When I decided to make the Growthbusters movie, I left a great career making good money doing propaganda films for big companies.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really realize at the time when I made this shift that I was choosing to become a starving artist. It was very challenging to raise the money to make the film, let alone make the film, but even, you know, I had hoped to raise enough money to actually pay myself a little bit of salary while I made the film. And I never could do that. So it forced me to, each year I had to streamline my life and live more simply to, because I was just running on savings. And you know what? Life never got less happy. My life became more happy and more fulfilling because I was doing something that I really was felt passionate about. And in the process, though, I was being forced to be a good citizen of the planet. I wasn't an over-consumer. I didn't go buy stuff I didn't need. I had to be very careful about how I spent my money. And so I think some good, you know, is going to, you know, we're going to be forced to make all the right choices. It's just unbearably slow.
I know. But it's too bad that we have to be forced to do it instead of choose to do it.
It'll be a lot more elegant the more we actively choose to scale back rather than waiting for Mother Nature to force us. It'll be more elegant if we can do that,
mm-hmm.
which I guess is why I'm here talking to you today. I'm still hoping that we're intelligent enough to actively choose rather than waiting for the world to force us.
Right. Well, I always say that myself. You know, better you make a decision than wait for the universe to make it, because when the universe makes it, it's usually quite dastardly. You have a guy who was a very wealthy man in Australia, Dick Smith, in your movie. And he said something that almost knocked me over. I mean, I hit the pause button and I was like, wow, that's like one of the most interesting sentences I've heard in a long time. Because I also do a lot of shows on, you know, big pharma, industrial farming, etc. where he finally comes out against growth, and he says, if we don't, the sentence he used was, we'll all be living like battery hens. I was like, oh my God.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
You know, to think of that, you know, Mercy for Animals came right into my head in all the films I've seen of the abuse and the conditions that, you know, hens have to live in. And, you know, when I look, I think of all those buildings. You know, originally I'm from New York, and I thought about all those projects. That's what they call them, housing projects, where you could have 20 buildings that are at least 50 feet tall, you know, 50 floors, and there might be 10 apartments on every floor, and people are living like they're in egg crates on top of each other. And I remember all those years ago saying, this certainly can't be the way we were intended to live. And when he said, we'll all be living like battery hens, I was like, wow, there are already people that have been living like that for a very long time.
I'm really glad you came back to that, because we started out talking a little bit about population growth, and then it seems like we've been talking about economic growth and overconsumption for a while. And it's great to come back to population growth for a minute, because it, in a way you're describing smart growth. You know, and that is the people who don't want to admit that the world is overpopulated. They don't want to recommend that people choose smaller families. They'll do anything to avoid this unpleasant subject of reproductive excess. They think all we have to do is just consume a lot less. We have to have renewable energy. We have to have smart growth. We have to pack people in tightly into cities so that we have plenty of land for habitat for wildlife outside the cities. And, you know, we just have to live differently. We have to give up eating meat. We have to, you know, there's all these things that we have to give up. You just have to step back and say, well, is that a life worth living? And I think that's what Dick Smith was saying, is that, you know, that all these sacrifices that we might be asked to make, and we are being asked to make because we're afraid to just admit that the world is overpopulated, we're going to end up just like, you know, a concentrated animal feeding operation, which, as you mentioned, it does not look like a good life whatsoever. So is that, I just don't think it's worth it when it's...
Absolutely not. I mean, yeah. You know, a few months ago, Bloomberg in New York City started building these 10-by-10-feet apartments, okay? To me, a 10-by-10-foot apartment would be like being in a prison cell.
Yeah, but, you know, it's the responsible thing to do if, you know, and in fact, you know what? It is going to be the responsible thing to do in a world of 11 billion people if we just can't bring ourselves to be sophisticated enough and smart enough to say, hey, you know what? This planet just doesn't work with 7, 9, or 11 billion people on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember, you know, it wasn't that long ago when people were projecting 7 billion people and nobody wanted to believe it. Well, look how fast that happened.
Yeah, and you know, the United Nations, that everybody looks to the UN for these population projections, and they just had to raise their projections in June of this year because fertility declines weren't happening as fast as their prior projections had portrayed. And so now, you know, it used to be there was this expectation that world population would start to level off just after the turn of the next century. Well, now that's gone. Now the projections don't go out far enough to tell us when it's going to level off. So the news is not good. We're not making progress fast enough at reducing fertility rates around the world. And when I talk about overpopulation and reduced fertility rates, I'm not just saying people in certain parts of Asia and Africa need to choose smaller families. I'm saying people, you know, in Dayton, Ohio, and Los Angeles, California, and Ottawa, Canada, and London, England need to be choosing smaller families too, because we're the ones with the huge footprints.
All right. Well, you know, I have interviewed a gal who is part of a group called Childless by Choice. You know, and I think it's a good thing. A lot of women, you know, always have been forced by society. Oh, what do you mean you're not married or you don't have kids? But now there's a whole movement of people choosing not to have children. and realizing that that's their right. Not everybody has to reproduce on the planet.
Yeah, and that's another little part of the cultural narrative that, you know, that of a woman's, you know, we've kind of grown up being programmed to believe that that's really one of a woman's primary life functions is to reproduce and raise kids. And there are so many teenage girls who really don't have any other purpose in life. I mean, they just think, you know, I got to get married and start making babies. That's their only purpose in life. And I'd like to help open their eyes to the possibilities of all the contributions that they can make to the world. And, you know, certainly if they want to conceive a child, I don't want to prevent them from doing that. I'd like them to be really well informed about, you know, what their choices about family size mean for the quality of life of their kids. But I want them to be fully informed that, boy, they can be president of the United States if they want. They can. There are a lot of things they can do that bring meaning to the world that do not require them to conceive children.
I agree. You know, I had my children in the 70s, and, you know, the way that it happened was I had a girl first, and then I had a boy. And then I said to my husband, I'm done. We have one of each, we're done, and that's what I'm doing for society. And that was the way that went.
Yeah, and, you know, people who want a large family, there are plenty of opportunities for adoption if you really want a large family. So I think because of the population taboo, this taboo on discussing this subject, you know, prevents couples around the world from really understanding the ramifications of their decisions. Mm-hmm. I really think every couple really wants the best possible life for their kids. And so going forward, that means if you want the best possible life for your kids, that means you do not want to conceive a large brood, a quiverful of kids, because that if everyone does that, then your children will have to carry an AK-47 to the grocery store.
Crazy days indeed. You know, I remember a conversation I had with my dad when my kids were young, which we're looking at, you know, maybe 1980. But my father really started raising us around 1950. So he had, you know, he had five children. And he could support five children on a barber salary, you know, by himself. My mother never went to work. So, you know, when you look at, when you go from there to here, you know, where everybody's working two and three jobs, mom, dad, and anybody else, you have to say, you know, what's the point of this? And I remember my father saying, you know, he was a little taken back that I only decided to have two kids. And I told him, I said, you could never have afforded to have all five of us today. And that was in 1980.
That's true. And even, you know, we socialize a lot of the cost of raising kids. If any of us had to pay the full cost of raising a child today, very few of us could afford it. You know, we depend on our other taxpayers and our government to provide public education, for example. If we all had to pay for the education of the kids we conceive, right there, the free market would actually change a lot of our reproductive behavior, I think.
Right. Well, Dave, I have to tell you, I really enjoy your movie. It's not a frightening movie. People will enjoy it. It's easy to get. The messages are great. And I want to give out your website. I know you gave me another one, but you can get over to growthbusters.org. Was the other one growthbiasbusted.org?
Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to put live links to both of them in here. And Dave, I'll tell you what, if you come up with another film on maybe your wild travels, this growth buster, be sure to get it to me.
Well, I can promise you there will be another film.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
Take care. Bye. Dave Garner, the film Growth Busters. Who are you going to call? Hooked on Growth. And we better unhook real quick. Anyway, tomorrow I'll be back with the news. Thank you for supporting the show. Share the info with anyone that'll listen.
Thank you for listening and supporting the Maria Show. Tell others what you learned today. Knowledge becomes wisdom only when it's shared. Encourage others to subscribe today. www.maria.net. Often imitated, never duplicated. A world of information all in one place. www.maria.net. Always ahead of the curve. Always on your side. Get active or get radioactive. Subscribe today.